More often than not, when we begin to look into a particular subject for Please Explain, we find ourselves amazed by the world that has opened up before us. And that's very much the case today when we're going to talk about Neanderthals. I can guarantee you that you'll not be thinking of them afterward in the same abstract mists of time way that you may have before. Joining us now are Jamie Shreve, executive editor for National Geographic, author of The Neanderthal Enigma, Solving the Mystery of Modern Human Origins, and Shara E. Bailey, associate professor of the Center for the Study of Human Origins at the Department of Anthropology at NYU. She's also associate editor of the Journal of Human Evolution and is on the editorial board of the Yearbook of Physical Anthropology. Jamie and Shara, thank you so much for joining us on today's Please Explain.
Great to be here.
And we also invite our listeners to join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WNYC or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So before we begin, Jamie, because your book spells the word Neanderthal without an H, how do people in the field pronounce the name that we have been, we're talking about here, Neanderthal or Neanderthal?
I've always wondered how many Google hits I missed by leaving out that H. They pronounce it Neanderthal. It's a German word. It means the Neander Valley.
That's where the first bones were found?
That's correct, in 1856. Correct me, Cher, if I'm wrong about that one, but I think it's 1856. So we use the German pronunciation. And for a while, the spelling T-A-L was actually preferred in the scientific community, but now most people use T-H-A-L.
Where did that H come from, Shara? Hello, Shara?
Oh, hello. I can barely hear you there.
Oh. Well, I think that I don't know why. Maybe we can zip up the connection with her a bit more. If we find ancient bones, would we know immediately if they're Neanderthal?
Do you want me to answer that while we're waiting for Shara?
Okay, now I can hear you.
Okay. You heard the question?
No, I didn't hear the question. I heard stuff in the background.
If we find ancient bones, would we know immediately if they were Neanderthal?
If you found the right bones, you would.
Now, I mean, if you just looked at them, would you say, Neanderthal, or would you have to do a little more close examination?
It really depends on which bones you find. There are a number of features that are definitely diagnostic of a Neanderthal. So if you, and my specialty is teeth, so if, for example, I found an upper first molar, these are your chewing teeth, I could tell you pretty certainly that it was if it was a Neanderthal or not, just by that one single tooth. But there are aspects of the skull as well, something called a superenniac fossa, different features you can see on the skull that are in extremely high frequencies in Neanderthals and very rare in modern humans. So if you had the right part of the skeleton, yeah.
And the teeth are that different? There are no humans who would have teeth that would look like a Neanderthal tooth?
In certain teeth.
I've met some people I've wondered about.
Yes. So if you have the right teeth, yeah. I mean, generally Neanderthal teeth look a lot like humans. But there are a number of key teeth like the upper first molar and the lower second premolar. Your dentist calls it your bicuspid. That's a very, very diagnostic tooth as well. And lower molars as well. They have features that are present in 95% of Neanderthals and maybe 4 or 6% of modern humans. So, yeah.
Jamie, were Neanderthals their own species, a distinct species?
Well, that's a loaded question because it gets into what is a species. But I would say the quick answer is the most common definition of species is a population that breeds with itself and with nothing else.
So then they're not because they interbred with modern humans.
That some way people would use that as evidence to say that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens sapiens, us, are the same species based on this genetic work that came out originally in 2010, showing that we were interbreeding. But that's not necessarily a done deal because a lot of species out there have sort of hybrid zones where they interact between two species and do, in fact, produce viable offspring but are not really the same species.
Shara, how much are we genetically related to the Neanderthals? I've read that we differ in DNA by just 0.12%. That's
0.12%.
Very little.
Yeah, well, we're the Neanderthal and modern human are about 99.7% identical in their base pairs. So we're very, very similar.
Wasn't it generally argued until fairly recently that there hadn't been any interbreeding? What's led to the changing on that?
Well, the original studies were done on mitochondrial DNA, and which is inherited in a different way than it's a different type of DNA. Actually, you have, inside your cell, you have these little organelles called mitochondria, and each one of those has its own DNA, or the same DNA in all the mitochondria, but it's different from the nuclear DNA, which is what these new studies were based on. And so, based on the mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down only by the mother, people could not detect any Neanderthal signal in modern humans.
And where did they find that mitochondrial DNA? In the bones?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's in everybody's cells. So if you have cells, then there'll be mitochondria, which are these organelles.
Jamie, what do we know about where and when the Neanderthals appeared?
I believe now the thinking is they first evolved as a full Neanderthal suite of characteristics in about 200,000 years ago in Eurasia.
But did they share a common African ancestry with other hominins?
Well, everything has to go back at some point and share that common ancestor. And we share a common ancestor with Neanderthals in Africa about 600,000 years ago. So that a population of somethings went out of Africa sometime after that time, evolved this very distinctive suite of characteristics, some of which Shara mentioned in the teeth, but in the skull, in the face, there's this big projecting midface and a low skull and brow ridges and all this other stuff that's fairly identifiable. And they evolved this independently, and then our ancestors came out of Africa again later, 60,000 years or so, encountered these other humans and did it in breeds.
They were all over Eurasia, weren't they? They go from the Atlantic to Siberia.
Correct, and this is why I called my book the Enigma, because this is a species or a population that was incredibly successful across a great piece of territory for a very long time. They were very well adapted to this cold environment. They were large-brained. They were immensely strong. And they couldn't lose, but then they just lost. They just disappeared.
Shara, wasn't there another group, the Denisovans, who are similar to the Neanderthals?
Well, the Denisovans,
Denisovans, I'm sorry.
Yeah. We know them based on a pinky bone and two teeth. But they were lucky enough to extract very high quality DNA from the bone that they found. As far as the teeth go, I've looked at I have a cast of the Denisovan, one of the Denisovan teeth in my lab, and unfortunately it's a second molar, so it's not terribly diagnostic. It's big, but in terms of it doesn't look like a Neanderthal, but Neanderthal upper second molars aren't terribly diagnostic.
But it doesn't look like a modern human either?
No, not really. I mean, it's quite large, although you can get modern humans with very large teeth. But it's just kind of primitive looking. Let me put it that way.
My guests are Shara Bailey and Jamie Shreve. We are talking about Neanderthals and related subjects. The word Neanderthal has been associated with primitiveness and even stupidity. My sense is that there has been a great change recently in our understanding of that as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. Shara, do you want to answer that? Because you're up to date on it.
It doesn't matter. I was just going to say that our perception of Neanderthals has changed quite a bit over the years. But go ahead, Jamie.
Well, I was going to say that we got that impression by comparing Neanderthals to the modern humans that came immediately after them, what used to be called Cro-Magnons, which is really not fair. It's sort of like comparing a horse and buggy to a Chevrolet and saying, ooh, the horse and buggy doesn't go as fast. If you compare Neanderthals to modern humans who were alive at the same time in Africa, their tool technologies, their level of, well, maybe somewhat more less artistic, I don't know, but they have all the
accoutrements. They didn't leave any art?
They left some art. I believe it's pretty well established now that you know, pendants?
I would have to. I beg to differ on that. Right. As far as the art goes, I mean, there's really only two pieces. One, a hypothetical Neanderthal flute from Slovenia, and then there's the mask from the Loire Valley in France of a site called La Roche. Other than that, we don't really have any evidence of Neanderthals creating art, and those two are dubious at best.
Yeah.
No, so they weren't putting things on cave walls?
No. No, I was thinking more in a broader sense, or use of ochre. There's been ochre.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm. Possibly feathers.
Feathers, beads, things like, I mean, shells. You know, finding objects which have value beyond their functional value.
Because they also had functional objects.
They had symbolic tools. Value. Well, they definitely had tools.
Yes, yeah, very good tools.
Yeah.
Tools that were comparable to modern, I guess we should say, do we use Cro-Magnon anymore?
Well, I haven't heard that for a while. Should
not
I
really,
you?
Yeah. No, I don't. But you have to keep in mind that the modern, there are modern humans in, as you know, Jamie, in the Near East, in Israel, for example, these sites called Kafsa and Skuhul, that were more or less possibly coexisting with Neanderthals or about the same time, and they were using the same tools as Neanderthals. So as Jamie pointed out, it wasn't until this second dispersal out of Africa, which were the Upper Paleolithic humans, the Aurignacian people, that you see a big increase in tool sophistication, art, all that, this explosion of art, all that comes much later. The earliest modern humans were using the same Mousterian tools that Neanderthals were.
Do we have any sense of, you said that they had large brains.
Yes.
So
yeah.
What would that suggest about what they could do and couldn't do?
Well, they could. We don't know what their limits were that way.
We don't know whether they spoke or not.
There's some sort of indirect evidence that they had the ability to speak. They didn't have. There's a hyoid bone in your throat that was found in a Neanderthal skeleton in Israel that is associated with the ability to speak. But we don't really know. They didn't leave any record of that. The big brains. I mean, the brains are a little bit differently shaped. But they were, on average, slightly larger, and that doesn't mean they were slightly smarter. It's very difficult to tell. But they did certainly have the potential, and that's what's so ultimately fascinating about them, is they were human. They were just a different kind of human.
We have found a frozen human and learned an awful lot about ancient peoples from him, but we've never found a frozen Neanderthal.
No.
Not yet. Yeah. Wow, that would be cool. Yes, that would be very cool.
That would clear up a lot of questions.
Yes.
Do we have a sense of how well they saw, for example? I've heard that they may have had better eyesight than we do.
I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah, that's new to me.
Yeah.
Well, what can we learn from just looking at their genetic makeup? Have we done a complete genome?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much complete, Shara. I think the latest from Pablo's group?
Yeah. Well, they've done the Neanderthal Genome Project says they have completely sequenced the DNA. They do rather low coverage, though, of the genome. So the problem is that a lot of the DNA is degraded, and then there's a lot of contamination from bacteria and also from the people who excavated the bones. As soon as you touch something, you get your DNA all over it. So it's been a very difficult process trying to get the DNA out and to separate it from modern human DNA and the bacterial DNA.
A listener has written to our show page saying, I had my DNA tested by 23andMe and found that I had a little less than 3% of Neanderthal DNA. What does that actually mean?
Well, it means that person is a pretty average Eurasian, because I think the number I recall most recently is 2 to 4% is on average of Eurasians. Now, it's very important to understand that Africans do not have that, and that's how we know that the Neanderthals and the modern humans were interbreeding when the modern humans left Africa, probably in the Middle East.
There are no remains of Neanderthals in Africa.
Correct.
No.
Right. Yep, that's very clear. And then you have this Denisovan population, too, that these mysterious ones that Shara referred to earlier with the tooth. But the DNA is very clearly the distinctive signal of another mysterious archaic population that was also interbreeding with us.
Right, and more different from us than Neanderthals,
correct,
too.
More different.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know whether they interbred with the Neanderthals.
Actually,
sounds like a lot of sexual activity was going on in Eurasia.
Well, this cave in Siberia called Denisova, where the name comes from, has Neanderthal, yeah. Denisovan, and modern human remains all in one cave.
Ooh.
And it's pretty cool. I mean, it's really sort of a magical place.
I'm talking with Jamie Shreve, executive director for National Geographic. He wrote a book some years ago called Neanderthal Enigma, Solving the Mystery of Modern Human Origins. And Shara E. Bailey, associate professor at the Center for the Study of Human Origins in the Department of Anthropology at NYU. She's also associate editor of the Journal of Human Evolution and on the editorial board of the Yearbook of Physical Anthropology. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we will look more into the story of the Neanderthal on today's Please Explain. We also invite your calls to 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with our guest, Shara E. Bailey, associate professor at the Center for the Study of Human Origins in the Department of Anthropology at NYU, also associate editor of the Journal of Human Evolution and on the editorial board of the Yearbook of Physical Anthropology, and Jamie Shreve, who is executive editor for National Geographic. He's written a book about the Neanderthals called The Neanderthal Enigma, Solving the Mystery of Modern Human Origins. We are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's get to a couple of those calls before I ask some more of my own questions. Dan from Morristown, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for doing a show like this. I mean, I absolutely love it. My question is, you know, you talked a little bit about mitochondrial DNA and how no one alive today basically has any Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA. Autosomal, you covered with 2 to 4%. A person could have 2 to 4%. What about Y DNA? Is anybody walking around today with the Y DNA, any man walking around with the Y DNA of a Neanderthal?
Arnold Schwarzenegger, maybe?
Yeah, but, you know, how incredible would that be to find someone like that? I think they would be famous.
What do you say, Shara?
I don't know that they've actually looked at that yet. So that's a good question. The interesting thing that comes out of this, and you had asked earlier, Leonard, is what does it mean to have 2 to 4% of your DNA come from a Neanderthal? It doesn't necessarily translate into something like an Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you know what I mean? So there's no direct equation between how Neanderthal you are in your DNA and what you look like, for example.
You can be very wimpy and have a lot of Neanderthal.
Sure, there probably were wimpy Neanderthals, well, don't you think?
On average, far fewer.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your call. But we have mitochondrial DNA or mitochondrial proof that we were connected to the Neanderthals?
No,
we don't have any then.
The mitochondrial lineage goes female. It's only inherited from your mother and her mother, and there is no Neanderthal DNA in that particular piece of genome.
Now I've heard that one of the reasons humans may have a propensity toward diabetes might come from the Neanderthals. Would that be? Could we know something like that?
Wow.
They've identified a number of the genes that we share with Neanderthals, or a number of the, I should say, variations in the genes that we share with Neanderthals relate to things like Crohn's disease. Diabetes might have been another one. I don't remember that one. But, that's kind of the research that's up and coming now. Now they're trying to figure out exactly what it means. What parts of the DNA did we inherit, and is it because they were selected for? So there might have been things that helped the new modern humans, you know, coming into this new world, if you will, that help them be immune to diseases that Neanderthals were already immune to.
Do we know that they actually went extinct, or could they just have been folded into modern humans?
Well, that's a good question, and some people, there's actually a debate about that. I mean, some people would interpret the amount of Neanderthal DNA we have in modern humans as indication that, yeah, they were just genetically swamped by the incoming modern humans. But there have been other people who have modeled, using computer modeling, how many matings it actually would have taken for us to find 1 to 2% Neanderthal DNA in modern humans in Eurasia. And they've modeled that to be only between 30 and 50 matings over the entire time that they overlapped. And that's not very much.
Well, no. Perhaps only desperate situations.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Very, very lonely out there in the middle of the
on the steps.
Yes.
Bob from Morningside Heights, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm as to the question of the expiration of the Neanderthals. I'm wondering if your guests are familiar with the theory that they succumbed to the cold because Neanderthals were unable to manufacture sewn clothing and left them to the elements, whereas hominoids, is that the right term, were able to sew and manufacture warmer clothing, and therefore they survived the cold.
But didn't they live for thousands of years in a rather cold climate during the Ice Age?
They did. Well, what we see with Neanderthals is, yes, they did live in very cold climates, but when, you know, the climate has gone through fluctuations over the past 200,000 years, and in the coldest glacial periods, Neanderthal sites disappear from the highest latitudes and are really only found in the lower latitudes, indicating that they weren't occupying the coldest areas. When you compare that to the Upper Paleolithic modern human sites, they were actually able to exist in colder regions at higher latitudes. We find their sites where we don't find Neanderthal sites. So probably modern humans were better able to deal with the cold, but I don't think the cold per se is what led to the Neanderthal extinction. Now, the time period when they went extinct, there were incredible fluctuations in the climate. Within one Neanderthal's lifetime, for example, the temperature could have changed as much as 5 degrees Celsius. And that would have put stress on the environment and on the foods that they were able to procure. And then if you combine that with the fact that now you have these modern humans there competing for the same food, that could have been the final nail in the coffin.
Aren't we seeing a similar climate change today, or at least predictions of it?
Well, we're definitely seeing climate change. We're not seeing that kind of crazy fluctuation. We're seeing a steady rise in temperature. And it's a global phenomenon, of course.
So the Neanderthals probably wore some clothing. Does it matter whether it was sewn or not, or whether they were just wearing animal skins?
Well, sewn clothing is more protective. It gives you a tighter fit. It keeps the cold air out, so it would make you warmer. But Neanderthals had to wear clothing in order to survive where they did.
Right. Let's take another call. Estelle from the Lower East Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Yes, Estelle.
Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if your guests feel that there's any correlation between modern blood type classifications and early hominids or Neanderthals or Cro-Magnons or anyone else?
That's an interesting question, because historically blood types were used to differentiate among populations and also by implication to make speculations about ancient populations and movements. However, they've been so trumped by DNA that no one really, as far as I know, looks at blood types anymore as any kind of... Sharon, you got a comment on that? Because maybe there are, but it seems to me that DNA is so much more refined.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you.
Although you say that the DNA has also been compromised, it would be impossible for us to use the DNA we have to create a Neanderthal today.
Oh, wow. That's another interesting line of... line of research.
Wasn't there somebody who offered to do that?
Yes.
I seem to remember.
could have been George Church, Chair. I don't know. But the There is a movement on de-extinction to bring back mammoths and passenger pigeons and so forth. And, I mean, scientifically, it wouldn't be that
Jurassic
hard.
Jurassic Park, it's scary.
Well, yeah, that's a little far out. But Neanderthals are very much like us, and it wouldn't be hard to manipulate a modern human genome to insert the Neanderthal parts. However, ethically, it's really off the table. I mean,
Now, why would it ethically be off the table? We put animals in zoos.
Yeah, but this is not an animal. This is a human being,
and you don't know what would happen.
Yeah.
with that zygote. I mean, maybe it would. The person might be formed, malformed, or things like that. I mean, you can't do those kind of experiments on people. They just don't let you.
And Neanderthals are human. I agree. Really have to think of that as an important part of this whole conversation.
Leonard from Queens, how you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to know how come Neanderthals exist at the same time as human beings if there's an evolutionary process, which I don't quite understand.
Well, that's... Go ahead, Sarah. All right.
Well, Neanderthals and modern humans have deep separate lineages. So the Neanderthal lineage probably goes back at least 500,000 years, and modern human lineage, it's about 500,000, maybe 700,000 years that the modern human lineage and the Neanderthal lineage connect. And you can find fossil evidence for Neanderthal ancestors in this wonderful site called Cima de los Huesos in Spain, in the Burgos region of Spain, where they have many, many fossils that look very much like Neanderthals. They're not quite Neanderthals, but as far as their teeth go, they're pretty much Neanderthals. They just haven't gotten all the facial features. So if you think about it in terms of a lineage splitting into two different species, that's how you can get Neanderthals and modern humans living at the same time.
Is it similar to chimps and apes or whales and dolphins?
Yeah. The question comes from, a common misconception that they're primitive, that Neanderthals are less like us than we are. They're different. It's like the same as grizzly bears and black bears existing at the same time. They both have a common ancestor deeper in time.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us. Or go to Facebook. If you tweet us, our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's take another call. Jim from Brick Township in New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Sort of a two-part thing. I heard one of the distinctions in the categories was the voice box, vocal cords. And I was wondering if, in the more evolved sense, if it was an evolutionary development, the ability to communicate and relate where food is and such, and if that was an evolutionary trait, and in which of the creatures we're discussing the voice box was.
But do we need a voice box? For example, birds communicate. Many animals communicate through sound as to where food is and other things. Dolphins do. The Neanderthals could have grunted, or they could have made other kinds of noises without having a regular voice box.
They certainly communicated. I mean, they were hunting large game. They had to communicate with each other in order to coordinate those kinds of things.
It's a question of how complex the language was and what they were able to do with it. We really don't know the answer. I mean, could they say, hey, there's reindeer coming over there three valleys away. Get your spear, Joe, and let's go find them together. Or did they... did they have that level of being able to predict the future, being able to communicate actions that weren't present where they were? I don't know. I don't think anybody
does. Tell time, things like that.
Correct, right.
We can't really know that. Yeah.
Say, summer's coming.
Yeah.
Right.
Mike on Twitter asks, what was the average Neanderthal lifespan? Do we have any sense?
Probably around 40.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And that's because we haven't found any fossils that would suggest somebody lived longer than that?
It's a little more complicated, but Shara, you want to talk about that a little bit?
The thing is, aging a skeleton is not a precise business, right. Let's say. But we'd look for something that was very elderly, would be missing their teeth, or the teeth would be completely worn down. We do have some Neanderthals with very worn teeth, but they would have a lot of arthritis. And you know, people who are aging, these skeletons are aging them based on modern human methods. But it doesn't seem that there are any Neanderthals that are really quite old, and it seems to be that the oldest one is around 45 or so.
And it's easy to spot whether it was a male or a female?
Pelvic differences. Males and females differ in their pelvis and in their skulls, and with the way we sex them is usually based on how robust certain skeletal features are expressed. So we say that the largest skulls belong to males and the smaller ones belong to females, or the ones with the biggest brow ridges belong to males and the smaller ones belong to females. And we don't have very many complete, we only actually have two moderately complete pelvis, and one is a female.
Now, the brow ridge is an interesting thing. That's perhaps one of the reasons that we think of them as being stupid and primitive, because we usually associate that look with stupid and primitive. But it's also the look of apes, isn't it?
In a different way.
It's a different shape of the brow ridge.
Why would they even have that? Is there an evolutionary, is there something positive evolutionary-wise that would lead you to have that kind of brow ridge?
Well, it's a primitive feature. So you see the heavy brow ridge in Homo erectus. It's a different shape. In Homo erectus, it's more of a straight bar type of brow ridge. And with Neanderthals and their predecessors, they're kind of arched, like McDonald's, you know, the golden arches. They have these arched brow ridges that are still quite robust. And there are a lot of hypotheses about why they have that. And really, the answer is we don't know. Some people have suggested it's about the strain they were putting on their front teeth, that they were using their front teeth as kind of a third hand. But that hypothesis, I think, has been pretty well debunked. Other people have suggested sexual selection. Other ones have suggested that they had higher testosterone levels. We don't really know.
Let's take another call. Joel from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. There's a fellow named Bednarek who says over long periods of time, almost like geologic time, well, certainly human development time, that Homo sapiens has gotten progressively smaller. At the same time, that's been correlated with larger and larger social groups. Because when you have a larger social group, some people can do something, some other people can do something else. So the population pressure, we tend to look upon everything as being individual, competing on an individual level. But have there been any things that they found with Neanderthals that have large social groups any place, whether it's in the Mideast or whether it's in northern climates? Otherwise, you have those that are socialized basically for larger social groups versus those that don't have large social groups, as lots of other animals don't.
Right.
Do you want to answer that, Jane?
Yeah, I don't think there's much evidence for Neanderthals having large groups. You don't find sites where you have a lot of tools, a lot of evidence of occupation by many individuals.
But they did have family units, and don't the burials suggest that there was some kind of nuclear family?
The burials themselves are not totally, confirmed as, clearly burials. I mean, some places like the site that Sharon mentioned earlier in Spain looks like burials, also like cannibalism, by the way. So whether they had pair-bonded family groups the way that we do. I know, Sharon, if there's anything, I'm not up to date entirely in the archaeological record, but the last time I was, looking at this, it looked not clear that there was social groups that you could call families.
Well, it would be hard to do that. I'm trying to think, though. I think that there was, I think there was a study done on some fossils from Spain, Neanderthal fossils from Spain, a site called El Cidrón, And I believe that they actually found a link, mitochondrial DNA, that linked people together. So they were related members of a group or related to each other, at least through the maternal line. So that we have that. If you imagine that they're hunter-gatherers, it looks like they were probably living pretty thin on the landscape and probably not consisting of large groups. And I think that that could be part of the reason why, you know, eventually they went extinct, because you have a lot of these small groups. They obviously are having some contact with one another. They would have to. But I don't think they were living in very large groups.
Now, I'm sure no one really knows the answer, but Anita from the Upper West Side wants to know what were typical causes of death from Neanderthals. They died fairly young, but I guess other homonyms also died in their 40s and 50s at that time.
Well, it's us that are weird that we live so long, actually.
That's a good point.
There are other mammals that live a long time. Do we have any sense of why some do and some don't?
I'm thinking in terms of primates. Humans are unique among primates in that females live past their reproductive period. So, for example, in all other primates, as soon as a female goes through, there is no menopause. You just, after you, when you can't produce children anymore, that's about the time that you die. So humans are really strange in that we live past our 40s or 50s, really. So
I'm very grateful for that, by the way.
Primates are doing. Yeah.
The wonders of modern medicine.
Yeah, but I think that, Neanderthals lived a hard life. About every Neanderthal skeleton that they found is some kind of healed trauma or arthritis some of them, one skeleton, for example, had an arm that was either amputated or bitten off, and he continued to survive. He also had arthritis all over his feet, and he had a smashed-in skull that healed. And some people have suggested that this is evidence of group members taking care of each other. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but that's been suggested.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. But thank you both so much for participating in today's Please Explain Look at Neanderthals.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's fun. Thank you.
Our guests have been Shara E. Bailey, Associate Professor at the Center for the Study of Human Origins at the Department of Anthropology at NYU, and Jamie Shreve, Executive Editor for National Geographic. It's been a real pleasure.